It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running, there is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
Yade she e kli da she jene torich eatni shabashis chi na kudine da shanella shema e beith a chi auto beith a chi da she che tithishin date na sha auto kinthanish shahuan. My name is Kli Benali. I'm originally from Black Mesa on the Diné or Navajo Nation, and currently I reside here in Flagstaff, Arizona.
And good afternoon. My name is Shannon Lynn Chester, and I will introduce myself to you in my native language as well, which is the Diné or Navajo language. Yat et anolto. She'e yad sit na jini nishle. Senjikine bashishi na kaidina dasha che do tapaha. E yad dasha nala. She'e yad kwa kinfana de. Hawanish edo kwa shiyaho a. Ado enda alto amanishle. Ako hota e yad sana nishle ako ahiha la. So again, my name is Shannon Lynn Chester. I currently reside in Flagstaff, Arizona, which is just west of the Diné Nation. And my mother comes from an area called Tonahali or Tonalia, Red Lake, Arizona, which is just north of Tuba City. And my father comes from a place called Diwujibitwa, which is Greasewood Springs. And that would be located about 100 miles east of Flagstaff. I grew up here in Flagstaff, and I have always grown up with very close ties to the reservation where my grandparents resided. Had a very, I could say, definitely had a very traditional upbringing. And in the Diné way, we do introduce ourselves by clans, which is how I introduced myself to you in my native language just a minute ago. So in that way, I come from the Blackstreet Wood People Clan, and I'm born for the Honeycomb Rock People Clan. My maternal grandfathers are the Mexican people, and my paternal grandfathers are the White Mountain Apache. So in that way, I identify myself as a Diné woman, and I'm also a mother. I have 5 children, and I have for the past 2 weeks, I've really seen what has been taking place here with the different organizations that have been coming here through the Aloha One Info Shop and all the different groups that Kli has been working with. I myself was making direct essential runs to our Diné medicine men and women, our healers and traditional practitioners. I've been making contacts with them and taking things to them personally. So in the past couple of weeks, I was able to, and thankfully, Kli was kind enough to reach out to me. And so we sort of have a collaboration happening here. So we've got all sorts of different groups here, all kinds of mutual aid groups and different groups coming through here. It's just been really amazing to see. So to be part of this, I definitely wish that I could do more. And with these efforts, it really touches my heart to see how people can come together. Given the situation, sadly, and how this has hit not only us, but other people and other indigenous communities throughout the world. So to be part of this and do what I can, definitely very humbled and honored to be part of this. So I just wanted to extend my thanks to you, Klee, and for speaking with us on this day. So again, hello, I'm Yate, and I'm glad to be here. Feel tons of positive energy, sending lots of love and light and peace out to all of you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You brought up the info shop. Can we talk a little bit about the history and how that space came about?
Yeah, I'll try to provide the summary, I guess. The Talahuan info shop was started in 2007 by an indigenous youth group called Youth of the Peaks and a collaboration of some radical folks, including myself, where we recognized that we needed a space to organize in the midst of a very escalated struggle to protect the holy San Francisco Peaks, one of our six sacred mountains for Diné people. It's a mountain that's holy to 13 indigenous nations, and we're in the midst of a battle to fight ski area development and snowmaking with treated sewage on the mountain. And so we had a really strong movement of indigenous high school students that were really militant, really organized. They'd be able to mobilize like 200 to 400 youth to come out to demonstrations. And, you know, we just needed a place to organize. And it really worked out that we were also looking for a space to do media projects with a group called Out of Your Backpack Media. That was an extension of Youth of the Peaks to address media justice and media literacy issues, because they were basically being vilified in the local corporate media, saying that they were militant anarchist gangsters, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But the info shop, there's been two info shops here in so-called Flagstaff or Kinflene in the past, and we wanted to have a break from the typical, stereotypical white anarchist dominated spaces. So we intentionally created an anti-capitalist, anti-colonial space that has evolved into what we call conflict infrastructure. So it's more of a direct action resource center. We still have like an info shop element, but we do a lot of events because we have a pretty huge complex. And so the spirit of the info shop exists, but we don't really have a formal collective operating it now. Over the years, we've done everything that info shops are expected to do and more, but always with an anti-colonial analysis.
Just as an aside, I know some groups are having trouble keeping their autonomous spaces or radical spaces open since the pandemic began. Is that something that you all have had to deal with?
You're asking if we pay bills? I mean, there's because we don't have to pay utilities, because right now, at least in our area, the utility companies aren't shutting them off. So, you know, we actually got some of them turned back on, and then just so we didn't have to pay them, so things would be operational. But I mean, so we've been extremely resourceful, like myself and some of the other folks who volunteer with the space. You know, we grew up on, you know, the on and off the reservation with no running water and no electricity. So, you know, we're resourceful people. We know how to make things work and manage. We also had a massive effort in 2000 and I think 11 and 12 to buy the building. And so we technically own the building right now, even though we're paying back a big loan still, like a private loan. But the entity that we borrow the funds from is like really generous and patient with us. And sometimes we just don't pay them at all. And it's not because we don't want to, it's because we actually can't, you know. And so the powerful, like, you know, dynamic I think that exists in this area, and it's something that I think we've always sort of like built on, is that we've been doing mutual aid, we've been doing a lot of outreach and support for unsheltered relatives, those on the street, so-called homeless. We've been doing a range of other direct action support for a range of campaigns, and organizing different and mobilizing out of the space. And so there's just we have like a strong community presence and a regional presence, and a lot of folks see that and they support us when we put calls out. And so we rarely put calls out calling for funds. And this time, especially organizing with Kinflene Mutual Aid and a range of other projects, like people have been really generous. So we've been able to keep stuff on, but we also like, you know, are just not paying certain things because they're not priorities. We'd rather put resources directly where they're needed.
Can you talk a little bit about the process in which you all came up with the programs that you now are implementing? did you all sit down and try to hash things out? Did it kind of come out organically? Was this a process of trial and error? Were there different ideas that were on the table and people kind of focused in on this one? What was the process like?
I think right around the beginning of March, when there was a clear threat of COVID-19 in our region, myself and a couple of other folks posted a message on one of the local street medic teams that in the past has organized in and around the info shop, the Talahuan info shop. And so, cause we figured like they would be the best entity to look at, cause we just saw like all these mutual aid projects springing up throughout so-called US. And, we wanted to just see what we could do, especially cause it was, creeping close to the Navajo Nation. At that point, there hadn't been an outbreak on, the Navajo Nation. And so we, just put a feeler out, put some texts, just calling for people if they wanted to mobilize. Nobody really responded. And so we were just like, oh, looks like we have to organize it. So me and a handful of other folks that have been organizing around the info shop for unsheltered relative support and a few other projects like anti-police violence work, we just decided to formalize that. And we initially looked at the models that other mutual aid groups were using Facebook groups and also Google Forms. So we just sort of set that up preliminarily, but, we contacted, I have a friend, Taylor Hall, who organizes with DC Mutual Aid. So I contacted him and asked what their framework, like their methodology and framework was, because they had just started too, but they were really effective. They started with like a really strong pod, and right now they have really powerful pod organizing in the wards, like the districts up there. And so we based our framework off of their system. And so we already have the infrastructure, which is really great, through the info shop. So we established a hub. We established a storage and supply site. And then we just reached out to volunteers for deliveries. And so the hub obviously being something that can be completely decentralized. But because we have the ability with multiple spaces at the info shop, to organize, like we have enough space for like a hub physically to be there and then other hub volunteers to be spread throughout, like decentralized. They don't even need to be in the same space, of course. And then our supply and storage space, which is like the primary use of the info shop right now. Like we're a donation point, drop-off point. We sanitize everything and then we get it ready. And we also do distribution as well. So it was more or less just like, here's a need, here's a threat. And as things escalated on Dene Pekea or the Navajo Nation, we realized that we needed to step things up. And so at the same time, one of my relatives, she's Ethel Branch. She's a former Navajo Nation Attorney General. But she started a group called the Navajo and Hopi Families COVID-19 Relief Fund and Efforts. And just basically launched it sort of the same way, just doing like really quick runs, deliveries, like amassing as much good supplies as necessary, and then distributing them up on the res, just doing it very decentralized, with just reaching out to a range of volunteers. She started a GoFundMe, and it just sort of took off. And at this point, it has surpassed $3 million, which is insane. It's hard to even imagine that much money. But like people have been really generous since this started, and they've been the group, which is completely led by Indigenous women, both from Diné and Hopi nations, are leading that effort, doing multiple mass distribution sites. So basically like purchasing $10,000 to $20,000 worth of groceries, you know, from wholesale sources, and just doing sanitizing and then distribution in some of our very remote communities, and actually all over the reservation as well. And so we, with Clinthana Mutual Aid, we have a partnership with them, and we do, we co-sort of coordinate some distribution, and supplies, as well as, sometimes we sanitize, stuff. In the past, especially when we first started, we just sort of piggybacking off of each other, sharing resources, especially because you have to understand that, like, you know, the Navajo Nation, the reservation boundaries, is the largest land-based reservation throughout the region, or throughout so-called U.S. It's roughly the size of West Virginia. We have a population of about 20,000 of our Diné folks who live on the reservation, a total population of over 300,000, which makes us one of the largest so-called federally recognized tribes. And but when you look at the statistics, you know, there's a picture that of disparity. We have, you know, about 33% of our households on the res, the residents on, who live on the res, who don't have access to running water and electricity. We have only about 13 grocery stores that serve that entire area. And so we are essentially considered what is called a food desert because we don't have access to like good access to nutritional foods. And so many people, many families who live very remotely have to actually drive like a sometimes up to 200 miles, like round trip. And so when we started, you know, seeing the scarcity issues, like people panic hoarding, and all that in these so-called border towns, like Kinflenna is a border, it's a so-called border town because this is our ancestral homelands, but it's occupied by the settler colony of Flagstaff. And, but it borders very closely to the reservation. And so a lot of folks historically have relied on, you know, going to get supplies in these so-called border towns, like, you know, monthly runs, whatever, you know, especially very remote families. And so when the resource scarcity issues started, there were serious impacts. And so we just wanted to make sure that we were getting stuff out. Initially, our priorities were to get as much supplies as possible out to vulnerable elders and those with compromised immune systems so they could just shelter in place. And they wouldn't have to make runs to these outside communities where they might risk exposure. And this was all before we had the serious outbreak on the reservation. So I don't know if you want to add anything there, Shannon. I probably covered a little bit more because I think it's important to, we're talking about organizing, but we're also talking about the context and the space that we're organizing in.
Oh, definitely. So real quick, if I can just jump in there and say that for me, having come, you know, to the shop at the beginning of March to, you know, sit in on a couple of meetings to see what was going on and what the need was. And to, I know for you, Clee, you already had that, you know, we kind of really don't know what we're facing and how this is all going to play out and materialize. So I know that for you, you already had that sort of mindset as far as a preparation and whatnot. So I saw that at the beginning, and then to be here in the past 2 weeks more consistently and to get more involved as far as getting, you know, things, getting things organized and figuring out how we can have all of these items, essential items of flowing through here. That's where I feel like I want to step in to sort of get things moving in a little bit of a smoother direction. But as far as your question, as how the different projects out of here came out, and I can definitely say that it did all happen organically. And I can say that it still is, only because this is something that it's a brand new thing that we're really just dealing with. And I think a lot of things that happen more or less happen in the moment. And sometimes we have needs that we need to meet because like Clee had mentioned earlier, it as far as him saying it, it's a hub. I can definitely see that because there are so many different things going on here. You know, we've got shipments coming in that we've got to manage. We've got the process as far as how we are going to process all of that and have some sort of system in place as far as how we sanitize, how we store things. And then we have our unsheltered relatives, you know, coming in. We have had a recent outbreak in one of the shelters here. So there's that need that needs to be met also. So definitely a ton of different things going on. I can probably say it is definitely an organic thing that is just constantly just moving every day. And I, you know, just to be here to do what I can, I feel like it's not enough. And to see everything and how people are coming together and just it you know, sadly, given the situation, it's a big, definitely a massive thing that there's just, it feels at times there's not enough of us to get to every person that we need to get to out there. And especially those, our elderly that are in those remote areas that may not have, you know, they may not have transportation, or they may not have some type of way to get in communication with anyone, or where that we can reach out to them. So I feel, as far as for me, that's where I'm stepping in to make those contacts to determine, you know, who those people are that we need to get to, you know, sort of in places that are more difficult to reach. So I feel like just every day there's just always more that we could do, more that we need to do, and more needs that we can definitely meet up there. So I see wonderful things happening here, people coming together. There's been so many amazing people I've met so far. So to be here to get more involved with this and to figure out how that we can best do this to get things running smoothly.
How do all the resources come together, and how do you all manage that? On Instagram, it looks like such a massive undertaking.
Yeah, I mean, it's, as Shannon mentioned, it's really organic. We have, I think, primarily just because we've been doing the work, like the initial stages were just like either strengthening some of the connections to resources we already had, or because we were doing the work and we put it out there and we like, you know, got a social media presence and people were sharing like our needs lists and requests, like people responded, and many of them responded very generously. So it was just a matter of like sort of creating a bit of a map or mapping out like where what was needed, where what our capacity was, and then what real resources we had access to. And if we didn't have access to resources, what ways we could get them. And so that's just been sort of like a bit of our like framework or approach. So, you know, we've had like, you know, folks appropriate resources or donate directly like from corporate stores. You know, like we've had like just a mix of things, you know, from people liberating stuff, you know, off the shelves for unsheltered folks, to you know, folks just writing big old checks and just sending them to us, and or like, you know, the sort of like social media payment gateways, and using those as best we can. So people have been really generous. It's actually been one of the few times that I've, you know, experienced, especially like long-term organizing in a radical space, that we haven't really had to like, you know, sort of like organize shitty benefits and like, you know, like constantly just sort of like, you know, beg people for money. Like we've intentionally tried to stay away from online crowdfunding, just because I've seen that in the past, and there was like a lot of exploitation around Standing Rock. So many crowdfunding campaigns popped up, nonprofits like just preyed on that, and just turned it into an endless fundraiser that they're still milking to this day. And so like me personally, I was just like, you know, if we're going to do this, like we're going to do this with direct support. Like we got to find a way that it's like all coming from our community in some way. And if people do at some point want to like offer support from outside, then we'll take whatever we get. You know, if it's from a nonprofit, it's from like a foundation, it's like we don't have time to write for grants, like any of that kind of crap. It's like, this is an emergency. This is a crisis. And I mean, you have to understand too, that like the dynamic here is that the Navajo Nation had their first reported case of COVID-19 confirmed on March 17th. And then it just turned into a massive outbreak. To right now, the Navajo Nation has reported more confirmed cases of COVID-19 per capita than almost every U.S., so-called U.S. state, behind only occupied Lenape territory in New York and New Jersey. And so, like, we have, just as of yesterday, we have 2,757 confirmed cases, with about 88 deaths. And so, again, like if you look at it per capita, it's extreme. And so I think folks, like there was a lot of attention right away, and there still is a lot of attention focused on Dene'etah, the Navajo Nation. And so a lot of people are just like looking, who's doing what? You know, what can we do to enhance their efforts? Where can we provide that support? And so we've just been focused with our efforts as directly as possible. You know, we also are doing resource sharing. Like if somebody offers something that we can't manage, like we'll reach out to another group and make sure that they have access to it too. Like just this week, and maybe Shannon, if you want to talk about this more, like we organized two support runs for supplies up to Black Mesa in the sort of Big Mountain area, in the larger area where families historically have been resisting forced relocation and coal mining. It's very remote. Many of the families up there don't have running water or electricity. And a lot of them are elderly. Some of them don't, to this day, don't speak English and so forth. And so we coordinated two phases of supply runs with different, I think, three or four different groups that all came together. So we phase one, we organized with some support groups up in Black Mesa and the families directly with Kinfuna Mutual Aid. And then phase two was with the Phoenix Black Lives Matters Metro Chapter, as well as Phoenix Mutual Aid. And so we were just coordinating that whole effort into two phases of supply runs. And we actually just got done, packing vehicles, and they are en route to the Black Mesa area, but one of their vehicles just broke down. And so like I'm actually texting right now while we're talking, trying to get them another vehicle so they can get their, the supplies up, because the Navajo Nation, the government officials imposed a 57-hour curfew all weekend long. And so there's a lot of restrictions right now. And the Navajo politicians refuse to grant exemptions for relief work, humanitarian relief workers. You know, so we've been trying to do our best. But, you know, we have the threat of state violence on top of that. And so we're just trying to make sure that folks get the supplies that they need. So, you know, I illustrate that point about the collaboration between on a regional level between different mutual aid groups, because that's really how it's working. And so we really haven't, you know, I think there was one point, especially with unsheltered relatives, which is, you know, we've been trying to prevent, like we've been trying to strategize and find ways to support and prevent like an outbreak from happening at a community. But unfortunately, just 2 days ago, there was a big outbreak at one of the local shelters. But in the build up to that, you know, for past two months or over a month and a half, I guess, we've just been working constantly and doing everything we can. And people have been really generous. So, like I said, like resources haven't been that scarce. You know, and I was sort of also nervous, like asking people for money at a time when like folks are getting laid off. Folks, you know, don't have like strong economic security because capitalism is doing what it does best in crisis like this. It's exacerbating the existing disparities, and then it's failing to address any social needs. And so, you know, but people have been really generous and still stepping up. A lot of people who don't have nothing, you know, like just showing up. Like we just yesterday when we were packing, sanitizing, probably like, I don't know, how much food would you say, like, pound wise, like how many tons of food did we process this past week, Shannon?
I can definitely say it was about at least 1,000 pounds of potatoes that we went through, given the boxes that we had. And we've had, I mean, just the what has been coming here has just been amazing. I mean, so much fresh produce. We've got, you know, the apples, organic apples and oranges, onions, and all sorts of just different types of squash and zucchinis and watermelon, cabbages, just really just healthy, just good stuff that it, you know, to send that out there to, you know, already immune and compromised elderly. I mean, all of that is just it's really good to see them, that they're just getting, you know, all the good stuff and not so much of the processed food. But I think you had mentioned, Clee, that there was yesterday you had mentioned there was about 210 food boxes and like more than 400 gallons of water, along with the hand washing stations. And there's also been just paper goods going out there, along with we have people bringing I believe from different groups, right? Bringing face masks in. So we're providing those as well. And hand sanitizer, just things that me, myself, when I was actually shopping out there to get items for how I was giving direct assistance, it took me over a month to find some certain items. So to have, you know, all of these different groups working together to, you know, facilitate the organization and the shipment and delivery and distribution of these things that are difficult to get, you know, such as the hand sanitizer. We had a group from Colorado that was here 2 days ago. They brought some water and they brought a few gallons of hand sanitizer as well. So those type of items that are difficult to get out there, those type of things that are definitely in need are being distributed from here. So it's there's some really good items going out, just all sorts of things that have been packed up and that we're getting out there. So there was also that shipment that you had mentioned that have been coming in from different places, even companies directly. So there was that 2,000 bottles of Dr. Bronner's pure castile soap that showed up yesterday too. So just to see just everything coming in and for me to just I'm just amazed. I'm like, wow, you know, this is it's really just I can't even just give. There's so many people to thank. It's just it's overwhelming for me, honestly.
And one thing is, like, we've had neighbors like seeing us working and they're just like drive over a vehicle and they just drop off a whole, like we, yesterday we had like one of our neighbors drop off like four big boxes of canned tomatoes. Cause they heard about what we were doing. We had like, even the mail person, the delivery person, like stopped by the other day and was like, hey, my partner's making masks. Do y'all need any masks? So, like, we see what y'all are doing here. And so it's really been interesting. And the other thing too, is it's like, we've been hitting up the food banks, like, and just pressuring them to like give us what we need, and that's been working. The Phoenix Black Lives Matter Metro chapter folks are working with a food bank down there to get supplies, especially for fresh produce and other things. Like, you know, because it's hard to like push volunteers to go through like all these stores that, one, there's resource scarcity, and then there's also rationing. So like, instead of having volunteers like run around, and we still do that. Look, I still go to like sometimes three or four grocery stores a day, just looking for like, you know, what we need to just send out some packages to some deliveries. We also have like, you know, radical folks and anarchists in the supply chain who are like, you know, can help redirect, you know, appropriate items and send them our ways. And so some of these big corporate donations that are coming in, there's actually like, you know, some folks who are down, totally down, who are redirecting stuff our ways because they see what we're doing. And we're just trying to build on that. So hopefully that answers your question. I mean, there's a lot going on there.
All day, every day, something like this. Face up, ass down, pop a squat, the class is in session now. I'm about to give the keynote. First off, this is for my people. They trying to see Chavez on that C-note. This same shit is still fucked up. Yeah, it really seems so. Let's stop voting for these motherfucking gringos this year, let's set a precedent. Nobody for president, yeah, I think it's evident. The rule of law is a definite impediment to all human settlements. I'm searching for that betterment.
You ain't got no solutions, you ain't got no conclusions. Why you still bitching? What's your proposition?
I ain't got the answers, all I have is questions. I get the impression that the hell is stressing, so I keep it through ya, cause they stay talking that minutia, and I keep walking under that purple rain. Yeah, I call it fuchsia. They wanna color me bad, well it's all good, and the sun is stood. I put the politics aside as they continue to divide and conquer. Only makes me stronger, the beat is bonkers. We cut the deal with monsters, don't walk the way unsponsored. I fucking love it, let me keep it 100. The revolution will not be funded.
So let them hate, ain't no debate. No need for talking points, just let the music play. So we create, and then we transform all that bullshit when we demand more. So let them hate, ain't no debate. No need for talking points, just let the music play. So we create, and then we transform all that bullshit when we demand more.
You want me to say it, no borders is still relevant. Yes, we rap it elegant, yelled it, but won't it none of it. Feeling like an elephant in the room, still celibate. Unable to be fucked by political elements. Like homies making statements, shit talking that government. Cause BP's like a garrison, stopping us for the hell of it.
Skirk say adik anyap joge kwainona Larson kbo am jod jod wa gewar jukshan ida to no tam jod ka sai si sai chu jok homa ma ba kai chik go wani mata op kai ma to ju kore go kore pa op kai pach achim bi hoit achim pe pe ma ap juk hage kore Wasich, how much come? Huh, kyote. Wasich, how much come? About a wa ea. But a jia ea. Don't know them jorga. But a moka go katang. About a jew. But a nyga kvamira. Jod homo. Achim, be a mo. Be a mo. Be a mo. Apple. Achim, a ta a nyoka. Ida. Don't know them jorga.
Border agents and the borderland developments. Ain't nothing but cruel and usual punishment. Hella lethal as Bennett Patricio. Executed by the vehicle 14 years ago. Love to be peaceful, but here's the dealio. Fuck all these illegal Europeans killing Indios. All my people, Phoenix to Hermosillo. Treated not equal, cause our last names are Castillo. McGill and Felix, so I flip off Agent Lopez. At the checkpoint, dude raiding like Cortez. Invading my res, light conquistadors. Crusading for Cobra doors, road to riches to explore. And some call it reform, but yo, I call it war. We ain't taking no more, like Ferguson, Baltimore. So check our war party, gotta make them bounce. And the war cry we announce, or the awesome we pronounce. We sick the womb, only all of us together can be the blade that severs the tentacles forever.
So let them hate, ain't no debate. No need for talking points, just let the music play. So we create, and then we transform all that bullshit when we demand more. So let them hate, ain't no debate. No need for talking points, just let the music play. So we create, and then we transform all that bullshit when we demand more.
I mean, what we're putting out there as far as on, you know, on Facebook, I'm really not on Instagram at all, but I know there's a, you know, whatever we put out there, I see the response and just the gratitude. You know, that's out there just for, as far as the impact on how, you know, we've been able to assist. And I mean, there's so many other groups and people out there doing the same thing. And it's just been absolutely just amazing to see. I know that there's definitely more families that we need to reach out there. And so I'm very passionate about that. Just finding those people in the remote areas that need that assistance. So I have also sort of, I guess, closely followed as far as our, the, you know, our so-called government and how they've been facilitating distributions as well. So they have been going to different communities and distributing food and produce and essential items as well. So and as far as the what I see on the commentary that I follow on those, I honestly feel like there are people that we aren't, you know, that we aren't getting to. So I've been brainstorming lately, like how can I make more of an effort in that aspect to, you know, make sure that the people who can't drive up to these distributions that are very, I can see they're well managed as far as having no direct contact and items are directly placed in the back of their vehicle. But what I'm seeing out there is just a lot of comments and concern about those people who maybe don't have vehicles or who don't get this information so that they can go out to these community, you know, wide distributions and that they're missing, you know, these distributions. And so there are some families that aren't getting what they need. So I've been going through those type of comments and reaching out directly on personally on my end to reach out to those people and find out like, hey, you know, I know you're in need or you know someone that's in need, get a hold of me. How can we get this together and how can I get some items to them? So I think the impact has definitely, it's made a mark. But for me personally, my opinion is that it's not enough. It feels like there's still so much more that we can do. And so that's why I'm here. I'm here. And if, you know, there are times that we do run short. We do need, you know, more people here to help us or just help even load stuff and whatnot. So when we've got people here and things are moving along, it's just really amazing to see. So I know that as far as what I've been following out there, what the CLE and the info shop here has started, you know, the word hub definitely keeps coming up. So just that, you know, that just reaching out together in solidarity and just figuring out a way like, hey, how can we make this happen? You know, how can we work together to do this? So I can definitely see how that just flows. Just so I think, honestly, it's the energy of the place. I mean, we utilize traditional prayer and also, you know, we burn sage. We pray for everyone, you know, who comes through here. And, you know, for their well-being and for their safety and for their health. So I can definitely say we incorporate a lot of traditional thought into exactly what we're doing here. And so just given that, I think just the whole, just the energy and the heart that is in this and what CLE and his, you know, what he's already, his mission and everything that he's already been doing here, just kind of float along with this, with all of the, you know, the people that he works with and connections that he's made out there. And so it's just very, just like free flowing and everything just jives together just perfectly. I mean, somebody can pull up, you know, with, like yesterday we had over about a dozen vehicles, that showed up, you know, with donations. So we just pull together, we just get it unloaded, just get it moving, get it processed. So I know that there's a definite impact that's being made out there. I can see it. I can see posts being shared, pictures being shared. And, you know, that's why we post all of that, because we want people to know that we're here to help and we're here to assist and we're, you know, here to help other groups even. I mean, from what I've seen, the door is open to anybody. We set up the tables and sanitizing stations and we do whatever we can. We'll, you know, jump in there and wash vegetables, wash some produce, do whatever that we've got to do to get things moving. So I can say the impact is great. And I think it will just get even greater and even better. And we're definitely figuring out how this is working. I don't think any one of us were really, you know, prepared for something like this, for this type of crisis. So definitely that's where that whole organicness of it comes in. So definitely we just keep praying and we just stay strong. And, you know, it's for the people. And so we just keep moving with it.
You mentioned that the pandemic really started to hit in mid-March. Can you speak to the overall impact just on people's everyday lives?
The Navajo Nation, like on the res, has, or and around the res, has 12 Indian Health Service facilities with a total of about 170 beds and only 13 ICU beds within that. There's about 52 isolation rooms, and at, you know, I think as of a month ago, they had about 28 ventilators. It's changed because the National Guard has come in to set up large tent hospitals. But you have to also understand there's a context of Indian Health Service being substandard, you know, and violent against Indigenous lives. I mean, forced sterilizations in the context of the IHS facilities or Indian Health Service facilities was a practice up until the 1970s. And so, you know, we have, and this is something that I think is important to address, like there's a narrative out in mainstream media that's looking at the impacts of COVID-19 on the Navajo Nation. And, you know, what they see is poverty, what they see is a lack of infrastructure. And, you know, that's sort of contributing to the widespread reality that we're facing. But, you know, the issue isn't that we have, that we don't have like big box corporate stores on every fucking street corner. The issue isn't that, you know, we're just bad capitalists. The issue is that our subsistence ways of life, our ways of life that have been established with nature, not against nature, have been systematically attacked by colonizers for many, many generations, violently. I mean, the first tactics that the colonizers used, some of the colonizers used against us, was scorched earth campaigns by the U.S. military to subjugate our people and force them on a long march, 400 miles, to a place called Fort Sumner. And that was in 1864. That's called the Long Walk. It's part of our history. But part of the reason that they were able to subjugate our people was because of the scorched earth campaign, which meant the burning of our fields, the destruction of our orchards, and the decimation of our homes, and the outright slaughter of our people and lives and our livestock as well. And so there's been a systematic attack on our ability to feed ourselves, to live off the land. And so when we look at these statistics of 33% of people not having running water and electricity, you also have to understand that, like, that's because capitalist expansion hasn't necessarily been fulfilled in our communities, that many people were self-sufficient. But this crisis, again, has magnified the disparities that exist in our communities and this conflict, because, you know, we can't all, you know, sustain ourselves off of the land because of the disruption, the violence, and the interventions of colonialism that we continue to face. But we've resisted these. And so the impacts, and I want to speak very specifically about this, is that, you know, the impacts is, like, just yesterday I learned that one of my cousins, his mother-in-law, she's 93, she just passed on because of the virus. And they live in a single household with about 9 folks in that household. And so they're all isolating right now. My cousin was the primary provider for that family. And so now he can't work, he can't provide, they can't go out to get resources. And this is one story of, you know, as I mentioned before, the more than, you know, close to 3,000 confirmed cases with 88 deaths. And that's what we know of. So the impacts are extremely severe when we look at what is happening on a cultural level, especially with our vulnerable elders, our medicine, you know, practitioners. I mean, this is why the work that Shannon is doing is so critical. She's going out and directly delivering to self-isolating medicine practitioners to ensure that they don't rely on these, you know, runs to, you know, miles and miles away, you know, hundreds of miles away to go to so-called border towns to get supplies so they can stay home, they can be safe, in on that level. And so it's an extreme challenge. I mean, the devastation, like, I mean, we've seen many more, like, what I consider refugees coming from the reservation as well, or just getting caught up because of the curfew and then being forced out onto the streets as well. Like, we've worked with some unsheltered folks that were told that because they were staying in the Flagstaff area, they're not welcome back to their villages or their communities or their families because they're afraid that they would contaminate them. And so, you know, there's a range of like, you know, like we're already on the precipice of cultural genocide. You know, the devastation, the systematic devastation of our cultural ways of life is already, you know, hanging by a thread. To have this threat against our elders and with our medicine people, you know, that's where our priorities are. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, it's one the COVID-19 crisis is one devastation upon many that has been exacted upon our people because of colonialism and because of capitalism. Like we have 523 abandoned uranium mines in our lands that have never been cleaned up. There's never been a comprehensive human health study, but uranium is it contributes to cancer, high levels of cancer, and compromises our immune systems. The environmental protection, so-called environmental protection agency, has closed 22 wells because of high levels of radioactivity. So we talk about lack of access to water. We have to talk about the violence, the war against Mother Earth and our people, that has restricted our access to those resources. Our waterways were polluted. In 2015, we had the Animas River spill, which, you know, the Gold King mine spill, for those of you who don't remember, was when the EPA was doing maintenance on a mine and they breached a dam and millions of gallons of, contaminants flowed into, the waterways around the Navajo Nation. We've also had, decades upon decades of coal mining, and the burning of coal, and with coal mining operations draining the aquifers, and drying up our springs. So, you know, in the Four Corners area alone, we have two massive coal-fired power plants, the San Juan Generating Station and the Four Corners Power Plant, that are the combined, they're the two of the most, contributing factors for greenhouse gases in the so-called U.S. to the point where in that Four Corners area, which is also known as the San Juan Basin, if you couple that with the amount of fracking that's happening in that area, they are the cause of a methane cloud that is hovering over the Four Corners area that NASA detected from its satellites. So, you know, this is how resource colonialism has devastated, and it is compounding the current crisis that we face. You know, our people's immune systems have been compromised because of the systematic attacks due to resource colonialism, and our tribal councils have sold us out on that level. They profited off of our misery and the compromising of our people's health. So, you know, the impacts, like I said, you know, it's like we're facing this impact, and we faced other, you know, this isn't the first virus we faced. You know, you have to understand the context of the systematic genocide and bio warfare that, you know, the intentional use of smallpox blankets. You have to look at before these colonizers came, that, you know, an estimated more than 90% of indigenous people on what we know as what we call Turtle Island, you know, this continent, were decimated through introductions of colonial diseases. And so, you know, 1918, the so-called Spanish flu, you know, our people were decimated to a level, but we also had our medicines, our prayers, our ceremonies that kept us strong, and we survived through that. And that's a lot of, as Shannon mentioned, that's a lot of what we are basing our mutual aid work. So this, you know, this is why we call it Indigenous Mutual Aid, because, and why we call for a specific Indigenous formation of Indigenous Mutual Aid, is because the needs, the social, cultural, and political contexts, and the ways that we are being attacked on a multitude of levels is unique and distinct, and we need to address this on our terms.
You brought up the National Guard. I also know the Navajo Nation is currently suing the U.S. state for failure to disperse federal funds. I'm just curious if you could speak more towards the role of the U.S. government in all of this.
It's a question that I sort of roll my eyes at, just because when has the federal government ever given a shit about indigenous people?
For sure. Exactly. Yeah.
Go for it.
Just real quick. I just wanted to just say, I mean, there's always different ways that you can look at that. I mean, there's from the healthcare aspect. I mean, given that we only have about 12 healthcare facilities, you know, within Arizona and New Mexico, for, you know, the whole, you know, Navajo Nation, Diné Nation, which is, you know, like you had mentioned about the size of the state of West Virginia. So just given that, we don't have, you know, that access to the healthcare that we do need. There's all sorts of limitations on that, where recently they've even had to set up remote healthcare facilities within a high school gym and, you know, in tents in some of the larger communities. So there's I just wanted to throw that out there real quick as far as what you were, you know, back onto what we were talking about as far as impact and how this is impacting us. I kind of went off on something else there on the positive impact that we're having, but as far as you know, the state, there's all sorts of things that come into play right there as far as money and how it'll be distributed and whatnot. And, you know, Navajo Nation did get that $600 million, which is only 60% of what was to be allotted to us. We had already, you know, that was something that was within our tribal government that they were already had been anticipating. So we did receive that, but now there's a question of how is that going to be distributed? How will that money be allotted and what will it be used for? So there's all kinds of things that come into play right there. So as far as state, and I say that with in quotations, and there's a lot of different ways to look at that, I think. And I'll let you go ahead and elaborate on that, Lee. I'm actually packing a food box right now, so for one of our elderly medicine women. So just real quick, and then you can talk now. So I just wanted to throw that out there real fast.
Yeah, I mean, again, like the state's never given a shit. The federal government's never given a shit about Native people. And to give like a big chunk of change to an entity that was established in 1923 as a resource colony, like the Navajo Nation government was set up with the explicit purpose of signing mineral and gas leases. You know, that same dynamic exists, like throwing money or, you know, no matter how big the checks are going to be cashed, aren't going to solve this issue, because the underlying issue is, you know, capitalism. It is colonialism. It is the systematic attacks on our ways of being. And so anything that is not restoring that, anything that is not like bringing up and building up the power of our people and our ability to take care of our ways of life and our people on our own terms, is facilitating that attack, no matter how big the fucking checks are. And so, you know, I'm suspect of any effort that the Navajo Nation, you know, is implementing, any effort that the federal government is implementing, because, you know, capitalism failed us. This system failed us a long time before this crisis. And so it's not like they're going to care about us now. You know, I think that, you know, it's just probably more of a PR move. And the Navajo Nation government suing the federal government, they've done that before. They sued them over environmental regulations and issues regarding coal mining, and they just pocket the money. Like, there's a lot of corruption that's rampant in this the geopolitics that play out here. And so, you know, I really, you know, I'm a critic of it, just because I don't see anything good coming of it, and it just is an attempt to recuperate these capital and colonial relationships, when ultimately they're still set up to attack our ways of life. You know, as it's, you know, it's a slogan, and it's sort of like, you know, we can say it's like capitalism and colonialism, or capitalism is a virus and colonialism is a plague, but that's really the effect, the impact, if we understand it, especially from a cultural perspective, of the violence that our people have faced. And so if we're not addressing and looking at radical ways to not just redistribute resources, but redistribute power, and at the same time attack these systems so they do not recuperate themselves, then it's just, you know, we're just going to reinforce those systems that are based upon the destruction of our Mother Earth and our people.
None of your governments have clean hands. All of your governments have blood on their hands. None of you are different. You haven't changed because you haven't started your healing journeys. The moment that we have our voice in our backbone, you want to shut us down. And you think you're privileged to disrespect us the moment we tell you, because of your colonial mindset and your colonial way of being, your white privilege. garbage, you white fragility. You can't take our truth.
Wanted to mention something that just came to me actually, and I was discussing this the other day with someone else. She was here, and she has been Corrine Fairbanks, was that her name, Clea?
Yeah.
So she was here the other day. We were discussing a few things, and I had mentioned to her how just this is kind of a spinoff of what Clea was saying, you know, just the attack on you know, our Mother Earth, and how there's been quite a few stories and prophecies, not only within, you know, our Diné Navajo way of life, but in what I've seen, it's worldwide in different communities and different in not only indigenous, but, you know, just way back to, you know, ancient times. There's always been stories and prophecies of times like this where we'll need to deal with something like this if we as a human race don't change our relationship that we have, you know, with the earth, and to not just take and then continue to, you know, pollute the skies and the waterways, and that we've already known that if that relationship like that isn't one out of respect, where we only take what we need, then these are the sort of things that happens. It's the repercussions that come back on us, you know, as just a human population. So we were discussing some things like that, and about how, like I had mentioned, there's been, you know, sort of like prophecies here and there throughout, you know, the history of time where this has been spoken of. And so now, you know, we're living in a time where we're actually seeing it and we're actually facing it. And me being a mother, it's very concerning to me. And I have to be concerned about what kind of, you know, what kind of earth are we going to leave behind, you know, for our children? And what can we do now? You know, we definitely can't take a step backwards to undo all of this. But I feel like just the whole general idea of what so many people and so many, you know, great leaders worldwide, and just having that knowledge and you know, having shared these stories and that wisdom that has been ignored for so long, and now I feel like it's something that we have already warned. We've given our warnings, and so now we're in this type of situation, and just that wanting to return, you know, back to just that way of life, to where, you know, we just lived off the land and things were simple, and there was that respect for just human life and plant life and animal life, and just, you know, all of the life forces within the universe, you know, for everything to just, you know, all work together and be in synchronicity. I mean, that's been gone for so long, and now to have to deal with something like this and to see the devastating effect that it is having, not only just on our people, but other people worldwide. And specifically, I've, you know, recently seen that this is hitting some indigenous communities that are actually totally isolated, that, you know, don't know how much truth there is to all of that, given I don't, you know, follow the media, and believe everything that's out there and all of that. But just the simple fact that we've had so many people, and especially our elders, you know, we get signs, we see things in nature, they tell us things and they warn us of things. And we've been giving these warnings time and time again. And so just that communication, you know, with nature, it feels like it's been destroyed. And given our history as far as Diné people and the things that have been happened to us in recent times, and it's just to see that impact on our own people and our elderly, where, you know, they don't have access to things that they need right now. They can't go and, you know, get the medicines that they need from the earth so that they can heal themselves. I mean, that's really where I feel like I'm coming in, to get them those things like that they need. So
let's talk about indigenousmutualaid.org, this new website that you all have launched. It's a hub and resource list of different projects that are happening. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so Indigenous Mutual Aid, I sort of mentioned this before, there's like a need for, you know, a particular need based upon our unique situations and context in Indigenous communities. But it started as an information and support network, specifically with an anti-capitalist and anti-colonial framework. So the idea was just to like network the different groups, because on social media, folks were like trying to list out all the different mutual aid efforts that were specifically for Indigenous communities. And we just wanted to have like a way that we could make sure it wasn't just like lost and buried in a social media thread. So we set up the website just to make sure we had a directory, and more or less just wanted to create a collective hub of organizers so that way we could share best practices, and address a range of, you know, potential strategic opportunities, like sharing resources and sort of building like a larger, mutual aid network with Indigenous organizers as well. And so like, especially because mutual aid is nothing new to our people, like, and I think like, you know, I mean, even Kropotkin acknowledges this in A Factor of Evolution, that like, you know, he studied nature and he studied Indigenous people. And, you know, like he basically articulated that counterpoint to those looking at Darwin saying, well, it's survival of the fittest and competition overall. And so, we're not citing or drawing from teachings of Kropotkin. You know, we're drawing from the teachings of our ancestors and our medicine practitioners and our traditional knowledge holders to this day. And so, you know, there's been so many amazing and powerful acts of what we could call mutual aid now that have been organized for generations upon generations. But it's really good to have like a banner. I think that helps people consolidate like the idea, and then not as like a sort of like a ideological flag to plant, but this is like, hey, this is what we're fucking doing. There is a context to it. And we're going to push to make sure that like, this isn't charity, that this is not a handout, that this is, you know, it's not just solidarity, not charity, but it's solidarity and ceremony, because we have our context and our understandings and our relationships, not just with people, but with the environment or the natural world and non-human beings. And so we take that into account with our approaches. And we found great affinity with other indigenous groups that have done the same thing in response to this COVID-19 crisis. And so, yeah, we initially just wanted to put a directory together and some resources. But then we found like a lot of people wanted to donate. So we just set up a crowdfunding page on our website, and it's been just amazing, like how generous people are. Like initially the goal was just to have like $10,000 in an emergency fund, and people, like in 3 days we raised that goal. And so right now that emergency fund is at 22,000, and we've distributed over $11,000. And so those have gone out explicitly. The fund is explicitly to redistribute funds to other indigenous mutual aid projects that are radical. And so we've also been like, we have a form people can fill out on the website, but we also have just been like identifying folks who, you know, like are just like lone wolves sort of like out there in their communities just doing like badass work. And we just like, you know, connect with them, and then we just give them money. And so like not a lot of the groups that we're supporting aren't on even on our directory. You know, they don't want to be on the directory. It's like a lot of folks are not doing, you know, they're doing this like sort of in spite of the lessons that like, or in spite of the tactics with some of the lessons that were learned during Standing Rock, where so many people were just like there to take a selfie and profit for themselves, like sell a t-shirt, like, you know, throw up a hashtag. And then like, as long as you can prove that you're at Standing Rock, somebody's going to give you money because they care about poor victimized natives. You know, when the reality is like, you know, that's not how mutual aid fucking works at all. And we want to articulate that, you know, cause again, it's part of our cultural ways, but we can also politicize it, and it needs to, cause like, you know, the first wave of mutual aid organizing that we saw, there's some really powerful like frameworks that were, you know, from groups like Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, who've been doing it, you know, for many years now, you know, since Katrina and before, and many other groups that, you know, some of my friends have worked and volunteered with on that level. And I've been doing, you know, in and out of like radical mutual aid projects to some degree in the past as well. And so we're just like, you know what, like we can see like the democratic, like, you know, like the sort of salivation, like the Democrats are salivating and their claws are out, just like the Occupy movement. They sort of gutted the Occupy movement and co-opted a lot of the energy and the resources, and it destroyed it. It was one factor that destroyed it. I mean, there are probably many more factors, but you know, we could see the sort of like nonprofit co-optation that was already happening with mutual aid. We could see the way like a lot of the indigenous, like large indigenous nonprofit groups were like using the term mutual aid. And we know like, one, they haven't like done any of the fucking work. And two, like those resources that they were going to start distributing weren't going to go to the people like on the ground that were doing like the hard fucking work. You know, they're going to go to other like large organizations that just say, oh, now we have a campaign, a mutual aid campaign. Now we have a, you know, just use the term and create like a small proposal, and we will get rain down checks from the nonprofit industry. And so, we just set up the site to intervene on that. But we're also putting resources together. Like right now on our page, we have like a sort of like 101 how to start a mutual aid project. And we're turning that into a zine right now. It's like really rough. And then we're putting other resources together based upon the participation of other groups that are part of this network that's growing. So, yeah, that's a bit of a short of it, but it's an intervention. I mean, it really is an intervention because like, you know, there's all these other mutual aid groups popping up, and it's just like the name of your show, right? What's the name of your show? This is America. Is that?
This is America. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, fuck that. It's like you have an anti-colonial, like, analysis that you put in your like outreach, but then if you can have a show that says this is America, what's the narrative that's out there? It's like this needs to be a conflict narrative, and mutual aid needs to be also about defense. And it's just like if we come out of this with people reinforcing colonial relationships, if we recuperate colonialism, if we're not radically like, you know, as I mentioned before, radically redistributing resources and power and shifting these narratives, then we're just reinforcing and recuperating those systems that have been attacking us. And this is a prone. This is a powerful opportunity where it's prone. It's at its weakest. So let's like shift these narratives. Let's shift the our tactics and our strategies and go deeper than that. And so that's part of where like the interests with the small crew of folks that are, part of that helped to formulate the Radical Indigenous Mutual Aid Emergency Fund and Indigenous Mutual Aid in and of itself, and part of hopefully where the network goes. But I mean, the network is going to, you know, most people who are part of the network now are just like on the ground, like in the front lines of the communities, just like doing the day-to-day stuff that we're doing here too.
For people listening, what overall lessons would you impart to them?
Just from what I've seen just right off, I mean, I'm the one who's come in here just wanting to get organized. I think organization is definitely key as far as, especially when you've got food and produce and, you know, all sorts of, items coming in that are going to really almost already vulnerable, you know, community and people, and just the level of care that needs to be put into place as far as the processing of the items, as far as how they will be cleaned and sanitized and boxed up and delivered, you know, in a safe, no contact, you know, way, so that we're not spreading anything else around. So I think as far as, you know, when it comes to, you know, that type of distribution, I think there's, definitely, strict level of care and guidelines that need to fall into play right there. I personally have certifications in food safety and sanitation. So when it comes to food, you know, there's certain protocols and guidelines that need to be followed. And so I think we've been doing a really good job of following all of that, and any groups that are coming through here, that process, it gets better every time. So there's definitely a way to do this and to box everything up and to not cross contaminate and to make sure that everyone is masked and has the gloves and that there's just, a strict set of protocols in place, to keep these items safe and to make sure that, you know, they get safely to the people who need them. So that's all I really have to say as far as that goes right there.
And I would just add that, like, you know, one, you know, we highly recommend that you, before you start any mutual aid efforts, like research what work has already been done in your area, if there's existing groups, and see which ways you can join our enhancer efforts, but also like recognize that mutual aid should be decentralized. Like, you know, there shouldn't be just one mutual aid hub or group operating in, like, especially a large region. It should be proliferated, like stabilize one mutual aid project and then help build that out and help that grow. Like, we should actually have like multiple mutual aid efforts, like interconnected, throughout like one community. And that's why the pod like organizing, I think, is really powerful, and a good model to keep proliferating as well. I think just to reinforce what Shannon said, is just like, you know, this is a life-threatening virus. So we need to be as, you know, serious as possible. And we've seen this, unfortunately, like even in our own community on the Diné Nation and in Hopi communities where folks are organizing like, you know, some small projects or they're doing a big food run and they're not doing any sanitizing or they're doing minimal sanitizing. And then they're doing contact deliveries. So they're actually going into the homes of elders. And we don't want that to happen at all. So like research, the most up-to-date protocols. There's already some really good ones on Mutual Aid Disaster Relief site as well. And just familiarize yourself with that and then commit to it. Like if you're going to take shortcuts, then don't do it. If you don't have the capacity and resources to be able to maintain those protocols at the highest standard, then don't do it because you potentially put people at risk. And so I think that that's the first thing to be really serious about. And then like build that out as a culture, like just as much as we would do like security culture trainings and like, you know, discipline within like affinity groups, like we need to be on that same tip with our safety protocols as well. And so like I also think like especially in an indigenous context, like I think our culture should be our first frameworks for action. So this ensures that we maintain like the necessary spiritual grounding that it takes for us to maintain and sustain this challenging work. Because if you talk to anybody who's done mutual aid work before this crisis or like any prolonged, like, you know, sustained work, whether it's even in info shops and all that, it's like burnout's a real thing. And especially like the amount of trauma that you can be exposed to working with, you know, communities in communities that are being devastated by this virus. Like we need to be, you know, prepared to make sure that we think long term and think through like the support that we need to sustain and maintain this kind of organizing. It's really critical. And so like, again, from an indigenous standpoint, it's like our culture is our first framework for action. And then like think about scalability too. It's just like, you know, some of mutual aid organizing and some of the interesting like benefit of this, like, you know, the social distancing issues is like, it's actually, we don't need more people to be organizing. We need smaller people in a concentrated way that's like then spanned out and like empowered through like the networks that we have that can be decentralized. So like, that's a really interesting dynamic and powerful. You know, it's just like, we're not looking for concentrated marches and all that kind of shit, you know, like the activist theater, you know, it's sort of out the door. It's like, you know, we need to, look at our environment, look at our capacity, what resources we have access to, what resources we need to build, what capacities we need to build, and then try to be as effective as possible. I also think we need to be thinking long term and like plan for stages of escalation. It's just like in certain communities like Gallup, New Mexico, a so-called Gallup, New Mexico, border town to the Navajo Nation, very close proximity where a lot of folks from the reservations, especially on weekends, would go do supply runs. You know, they just shut down and they have effectively implemented a martial law. And so, you know, what is our preparation for that in our communities when we start facing escalation of state violence and restrictions on relief efforts? How do we make sure that we are prepared with our strategies and our tactics to be fluid enough or to challenge the fucking state and, you know, and all of that? And I think like, you know, so there's a range of frameworks. Like the other thing is just to look at other mutual aid projects that exist in your region or like exist that are being effective in other parts of the so-called US or the world and contact those organizers and ask them what, like, you know, lessons they can share, what ways, like, you know, what like organizing tips and strategies would work for them. So that way we can be as effective as possible, because this is the time to share and build and explore and don't be afraid to be creative and take risks as long as we're not risking our people's safety, you know, those who are we're trying to support. So I think it's really important to establish like agreements, you know, especially in the context of like anti-colonial struggle. It's like, you know, I'm not saying like we need to have land acknowledgments, because fuck that, you know, it doesn't mean shit. When our people are suffering and struggling, it's just like we need to look at building in agreements to elevate in many ways the struggle of indigenous folks in organizing as well. And I mean, there's a lot I could say to that, but I think that's a lot of what's being articulated with indigenous mutual aid as well. I think like a lot of people are relying also on like digital communications, but like on the Navajo Nation, we don't have access to a lot of that. You know, like we can't ask everybody just to fill out forms. We can't ask everybody just to like communicate, you know, from their homes digitally. It's like we have to actually go out or rely on radio. So like pirate radio is a great option. Like, where's all the people like at that we can tap on and connect to distribute pirate radio stations to these remote communities, and other creative forms of direct communication as well. And so I think just like, you know, looking at the long term also is building conflict infrastructure beyond this, crisis is really key, you know, so like, you know, cause we're not here to aid and salvage that the, like our, these systems of oppression that, you know, have exacerbated, only been like, exacerbated by this crisis, or that have also precipitated this crisis. It's like, if we want to organize to take them down, then we need to fight, intervene, and be creative about that, and maybe sabotage resource colonialism and ecocide. You know, our immune systems, as I mentioned before, have been under attack, for generations due to all this poisoning. And so what are the ways that we can intervene in these anti-earth industries and take them down when they're at their weakest? Like, look at, you know, attacking, the infrastructure, that sustains, this system. So that way it can't recuperate itself. And we're simultaneously building up the infrastructure to support the health and well-being of our people on our terms. And so those are the questions and the thoughtfulness that I think we could be building, towards, to ensure that we're actually dismantling and not just like, you know, being a mutual aid, project that the state is happy to offload its services to, or just something that recreates like the same charity fucking bullshit models that nonprofits, and mission, you know, Christians have missionized, you know, to keep our people down. So if we're talking about true solidarity, and not charity, then we have to look at it on those terms and look at mutual aid also as defense as well. What ways can we engage creatively in the fight, and to attack the system, as safely as possible, you know? But you know, we're no strangers to masking up, you know what I'm saying? So I think that this is like that time to really explore those strategies and try to create plans for stages, because we can see where things are going, right? But we shouldn't just be, you know, buffering ourselves to prevent further spread, which is critical of this virus, but looking at ways to stabilize, proliferate our projects and orient them towards attack, so we can make sure that we're thinking beyond into a future that is without capitalism, without colonialism and these other systems of oppression.
So it definitely, everything that Klee had said was spot on. And, like, you know, me being just, you know, coming into this, recently and seeing how, you know, just so many different groups can come together. Definitely the concept of mutual aid is, definitely there. And I think there's, as he had mentioned, there are, several different, you know, models out there to use, but to me, from what I'm seeing, it is also, to touch back on one of the things that we had talked about earlier, it is really a very, or, you know, organic thing, you know, just something that you really can't prepare for. And so you know, just getting as much information, if anyone else, you know, wanting to do this, just doing the research, reaching out to other people, and definitely working, you know, together with other groups. That's what I've seen work here firsthand. So
what would it mean to both continue this momentum, but also take this mutual aid organizing to a different level? What are your thoughts?
For me personally, and this is something that I keep going back to, because I'm very passionate about it. It's, you know, the people out there that we need to get to, who can't otherwise, you know, put that need out there. So the ones that are, you know, in the secluded remote areas, who, you know, don't have that transportation or that, you know, mode of communication to, you know, where we can communicate with them. And so that, you know, getting out to them, and I mean, this is something that I have been going over and over and over. How do I do that? How do I, you know, I can, you know, put it out there, but, you know, oftentimes people don't respond to that. You know, just that question. Hey, if you know of anybody who's out there, who's in need, who I can get to, you know, get a hold of me. So, you know, it's one-sided sometimes, you know, just making that effort. And so I'm looking for a way, how, you know, we have like a Diné, Medicine Man Diné Hatafi, association. And so that group is, one that I've reached out to just, you know, kind of find out where, our medicine people and healers are at in particular, because me having grown up, with those, you know, traditions and being exposed to, you know, all of those ceremonies and songs and just certain ways of doing things, which all falls in line with, not only is there a need for that when there's, you know, when there's illness and when there's hardship, but, you know, there's certain cycles, that we see in nature, certain cycles of the moon and, certain, seasons and stars that are in the sky, that we do certain things like that. So there's, you know, the people who have that type of knowledge, in particular, you know, our traditional people, the healers, you know, our medicine holders, those are the ones that they hold, you know, all of the medicine and all of the knowledge that we need to survive. I know, you know, just given this whole situation and this social distancing and in some situations, isolation that is taking place right now, there's several different groups, an influx of groups of where, you know, social distancing, you know, prayers and ceremony time, you know, where there's been certain times, designated where we all come together and we pray just within our own homes, how we know how to, and, you know, all of that. And our medicine people are, you know, doing, their own, ceremonies, the best way that they can, because, some of our ceremonies, you know, they're very, community and family oriented. They're, you know, where people come together and there's it takes, you know, a lot of hands, hearts and minds to pull something like that together. So I just, you know, spiritually, ceremonially, we're so distant from one another now, where we've just all sort of got to look within ourselves to practice that on our own. So whatever I can do to reach out to, you know, all of our traditional people that we have out there, it hasn't been easy. I know I'm confident and, you know, positive that I'll find a way to reach out to more of them. It's more been just a sort of reaching out to people and asking around. And usually people have a certain, you know, healer that maybe they go to or that they, you know, prefer to go to. So just making those contacts, talking to people in that way. But if I could find a way to, you know, sort of get some kind of something going where it's easier to reach out to them. And then not only that, but, as far as making like direct essential runs, I mean, rather than having, you know, 12 people going to 12 different places to deliver, you know, 12 different loads, you know, and have more people, you know, out there crossing paths and, you know, all of that. I think that, you know, just for me, I'm really working on taking items out in a large load all at one time. So it's just a matter of, I think, like streamlining things and, you know, just figuring out how's the best and easiest way to do stuff so that we're, you know, we're not, first of all, burning ourselves out. And then second of all, that we're, you know, able to do a lot at one time, you know, take things to more than one family and to be aware of, you know, how we're using our time to, you know, use it constructively so that, you know, we're not, I think, from what I've seen, we've, and the little that I've been here, I can see places where we can definitely improve on that so that we're not, you know, going, you know, taking a step backwards, but we're just moving forward and we're, you know, pushing these items and getting them out there. So as far as for me, I feel like there's still a lot that needs to be done. And still for me, I'm still in a learning process as to how this can better work, and just looking for constant improvements and looking for ways to just streamline everything. And, you know, I think honestly here, we do have the space. It's just a matter of how we'll utilize it. And I know that there will be more, you know, people and groups and donations and whatnot coming through. So I feel like I'm stepping in. I'm so thankful that, you know, Klee has, you know, allowed me to jump on board and just, you know, I want to be here. I'm a very, very passionate about what we're doing here. And so I'm so, so thankful that he's allowed me to just be here and, you know, just giving me space for my effort and what, you know, I'm doing, that we're able to collaborate on these things and pull stuff together. So what I'm seeing here is amazing. And I think it'll only just move forward and get better from here. So thank you for asking that.
Yeah. And so just like the next steps or vision, like you're looking at bigger picture beyond where we're at right now. So like I responded, like, you know, I've seen, like, especially on social media, there's like a lot of people who are like really fascinated about, like, you know, the hobbies. And just like, you know, they have this like sort of renewed inspiration from crafting, and talking about how they're going to restyle their lives, you know, in the post-apocalypse, you know, after this is all done, like, you know, talking about rebuilding their communities, fantasizing about planting all their gardens, restoring the local economy, and practicing more yoga. My response was just, if it's not actualizing the fall of colonial social order and abolishing capitalism, then you're just prolonging the apocalypse for the rest of us. So if we're not building that into our organizing, then you're just prolonging the misery. You're just extending one crisis. You're ending one crisis potentially, and extending another. And so, you know, like, you know, we don't have, you know, a cure for those systems of oppression, or maybe we do. And so that's part of the reason that we published, on indigenousaction.org. We published this piece that was anonymously contributed called Rethinking the Apocalypse, an Indigenous Anti-Futurist Manifesto. It was actually published on March 19th. And so, like, one of the things that it states in there is that, quote, you know, they will not be compelled to end the destruction that their world is predicated upon. We do not plead with them to end global warming, as it is the conclusion of their apocalyptic imperative, and their life is built upon the death of Mother Earth. We bury the right wing and the left wing together in the earth so that they are so hungry to consume. The conclusion of the ideological war of colonial politics is that indigenous peoples always lose, unless we lose ourselves. Capitalists and colonizers will not lead us out of their dead futures. Apocalyptic idealization is a self-fulfilling prophecy. It is the linear world ending from within. Apocalyptic logic exists within a spiritual, mental, and emotional dead zone that also cannibalizes itself. It is the dead risen to consume all life. Our world lives when their world ceases to exist. And this isn't poetry from my read of it. It is an understanding of our traditional cultural knowledge systems and the fight that we have right now, and the fight that our ancestors survived through. And this is our fight for future generations. And so if we're not envisioning that future and working towards it actively right now with our mutual aid projects, then how is this not just like another little settler colonial hobby horse? How is this not just glorified crafting? You know, maybe not 101, maybe it's 202. I don't know. Like, I never went to university, so I don't know how that works. But, you know, the inspiration here isn't about rebuilding and surviving apocalypse. It's about actually tearing down a social order that is predicated upon apocalypse. And so to me, that's where I'm more interested in having those conversations and practically what that looks like, and how do we actually prepare, build, and fight.
How can people check out and follow what you're doing and also donate?
So I know that Klee has a couple of different pages out there. One of them is he's got his Alahawan info shop page. He does have them on Facebook where we post quite a few things, just, you know, what's all going on here. And then off of that, he's got the Kintana Mutual Aid. And then there's also the Indigenous Action. They did put a link out there as far as that one is concerned, where they've gotten quite a bit of help in that. That fund there is actually what has been helping me get these items to our medicine people directly. So there is a link out there on that one. I've seen that, and just very simple. Anybody who's out there, just maybe even on their own, getting things out to their community or people in need, that is there. And I'm sure when Klee gets back, he can share more about that. But he's got, I know he's on Instagram, and we've got all those different groups out there. Everything's sort of all linked up, and we just share things out there when we can. So I know he can elaborate on that one a little more. I'm more so the organizer right now. All of this product that we have, we've got a couple of different rooms where we have things go through. So there's also other groups that utilize the space. Today, that's actually what I'm doing, is we've put shelving in so that I can rotate these items through, and they just come through here. We clean them and sort them out. And so I'm here today just organizing stuff. I'm more on the just kind of managing the food and making sure that it goes out.
So you can visit www.indigenousmutualaid.org. We have an emergency fund that's supporting like a lot of those lone wolves, and also some organizations that are radical, like Indigenous Communities Addressing the COVID-19 Impacts. And that fund is distributed like through a form, and usually the funds are distributed within 24 hours. Then we also have, and there's like little conditions, so it's not like some nonprofit bullshit. We also have KinlaniMutualAid.org. So it's KINLANI MutualAid.org. And that's specifically a lot of the work in the localized so-called Flagstaff region, and where we're emphasizing support for unsheltered relatives as well. And we're also interfacing with the Navajo and Hopi COVID, or families COVID 19 relief fund and efforts. And that fund and effort is at www.NavajoHopiSolidarity.org. So it's NavajoHopiSolidarity.org. And those are like the primary groups that we're focused on. But I highly recommend like folks to go to indigenousmutualaid.org and check out the directory, and then like support those, like reach out to those groups, or just click on the links that have their funding needs, or like links to their organizing. And so you can see directly what people need. So like look at the regions that like maybe somewhere you're in, like maybe amplify some of like the Two-Spirit organizing that's happening, like with the Indigenous Kinship Collective operating in the occupied Lenape lands. There's also another group, I think they're organizing on White River. Let's see. But yeah, there's a range of other groups that are just doing like really powerful work. There's like the Chai Nations Youth Council, which is an Indigenous youth group that's doing amazing mutual aid organizing right now. Alianza Migrante is doing amazing Indigenous support work on the so-called border of El Paso and Juarez as well. And there's a range. So just check out the list there, and just, you know, whatever you connect to, just like check out their needs. And there's a lot of very specific needs that some of these groups have, and then some of them are just general. But we're building that directory up constantly. I think we just last updated yesterday with new entries. But yeah, we're just organizing, connecting, and sharing resources and proliferating mutual aid.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.